Well, we're going to give you an Atlantis shuttle update here. Richard C. Hoagland, our science advisor, tells us that they are starting things to get ready for the launch, fueling and everything else. But he said tomorrow weather is predicted to be just awful. He predicts a no-go for the launch, but we'll monitor that. Richard will be part of the program tomorrow night to give us an update on the shuttle, the final shuttle launch, go or no-go tomorrow. And we'll have it for you on Coast to Coast AM. We'll also have your phone calls coming up next with our two special guests, David Destino and Carlo Valdesolo, as we talk about their work Out of Character on Coast to Coast AM. David and Carlo, we were talking about how anger can affect your judgment. And you were both talking about this before the break. Let's go back to that for just a moment.
Sure, yeah. We were saying how, you know, we brought people into the lab and we basically had them put on these different color wristbands, and then we would sit them in front of a computer. And it would flash pictures on the screen of people who were wearing red or blue wristbands. And what you would see is we could actually measure their mind's kind of automatic response. And when they felt neutral or when they felt happy, they didn't have any differential response to people who were wearing red or blue wristbands. But if you made them angry, their mind would show kind of an automatic dislike for people who are wearing the opposite color wristbands. Now, you know, logically, this makes little sense, but what we're really showing is it's an ability to cause a prejudice out of thin air. When you're angry, anything that makes somebody different from you increases the odds that you think they're a threat, whether it's political ideology, whether it's race or ethnicity. In this case, whether it's what color wristband they're wearing can actually create prejudice out of nowhere.
Well, it can indeed. Now, why is it that people also make very quick, hasty decisions about other people when they meet them? Maybe it's correct, but they do take that quick, impulsive decision when they meet somebody. Why?
Well, it's by necessity. So our brains have evolved over time in situations where we didn't have the luxury of taking our time to evaluate our interaction partners. We had to make quick decisions because if we make a slow, deliberate decision, and it's the wrong one, then that'll be the last decision we ever make. So our brains are hardwired to form these gut impressions of individuals right when we meet them. And unfortunately, in our modern day, sometimes these evaluations run contrary to our ideals.
The Out of Character, surprising truths about the liar, cheat, sinner lurking in all of us. If one looks at why other people are cruel to other people, does that make them less human?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We've seen examples throughout history of how humans can actually commit some of the most horrific acts against each other. And the question is how does this happen? And as we were describing before, one of the things that makes us feel more compassionate toward people is any marker they have that makes them feel or seem more similar to us. Well, there's some really interesting research coming out of Princeton by Lasana Harris and Susan Fiske there, which actually shows that one way that people can actually commit these horrific acts and cruelty against each other is to actually view the target as less human. If you look back at the propaganda of the wars, what did people typically do? They kind of, you know, in some ways animalize the opponent. They're nothing but filthy animals. And what we found is the basis for this, you know, in the research they showed that actually, the parts of the brain that recognize someone as being a human sentient being, when you look at individuals from groups that are very, very stigmatized, that part doesn't become active. And what that really suggests is that we're viewing these people as less than human. And once the brain makes that decision, it becomes much more easy to engage in horrific acts against them.
Yet somebody... go ahead, Carlo.
The opposite is true as well. So research from Adam Waits, who's a professor at Kellogg School of Management, has shown that when we anthropomorphize non-human agents like gadgets or robots or computers, then we feel these emotions for these gadgets, even though they're not people. When we see humanness in anything, that's when our pro-social emotions are triggered.
All right, well, let's go to David, west of the Rockies. David, welcome to Coast. You're on the air. Hi, David.
Hello, George. Hey. I wanted to ask your guest about a phenomena that I've noticed. I'm a psych minor, kind of, you know, just a little bit. But I've worked in several different companies, and I've seen this particular type of person that, you know how there's really hot-button issues like, say, somebody is, stealing from the company, or this person is a child molester, things that really get people upset. Well, I notice sometimes, in the different companies I've worked for, there is somebody who will push that button. They will say, this person is stealing from the company, this person is stealing, that person is a child molester. And then finally, when they spread all this mayhem, they get everybody all upset with just total slander against innocent people, then the person will say, oh, I never said that, you know? And I've been watching these type of people because I go from company to company, and I thought, well, here it is again, the same situation, you know? And I've seen a situation where somebody was stealing from hotel guests, and they were trying to find out who it was, and one of the maids was saying how it was this person, it was that person. Well, it turned out it was her who was making all the accusations against the other maids. And I'd like for them to comment about that.
Sure. I think one reason why individuals often will point the fingers at others is to actually cause some strife, either because they're trying to cover something about themselves, or because within that strife, it allows them to kind of disrupt the regular social network. And in some ways, individuals who especially have lower power oftentimes will do this, because if you can disrupt the power network, that gives you a chance to actually move around in it. Now, someone who does this habitually over and over again, I would have to think maybe we're approaching the realm of pathology. And Carlo and I like to point out that, when we're talking about pathology, we're talking about brains that don't behave the normal way. But there are certainly some individuals who, by disrupting the social order and casting aspersions on others, allow themselves to cover things for themselves or to navigate the social network in ways they couldn't, by kind of breaking up different coalitions or bonds that are there.
Yeah, and I'd also like to ask you about just the opposite. How can you protect yourself against people who make just outrageous accusations against you as well? I mean, you just can't, it's really hard to prove something that somebody's going around blabbing all over and getting everybody all excited, and it's going around and round and round, and then it's basically trying to put the genie back in the bottle. It's like, it's just a bunch of slander. It's all false.
It's very difficult because, it's kind of like when the judge says, jury, please disregard what the person said.
It's a little late for that, isn't it?
It's a little late for that. And once it's out there, it's hard to undo. And lots of research shows that people are willing to believe statements by default, and then it takes extra effort to unbelieve them. You see this now playing out a lot in the Dominique Strauss-Kahn case in New York, where this maid who was involved in this instance, associated with some people who were not very good and have told some lies in the past. And so now people are very ready to believe that, well, of course, anything that happened to her, she's lying about again. And what Carlo and I point, we don't know what happened, but what we try and say over and over again is past behavior doesn't always mean that you're irredeemable and that you can't tell the truth again. But in your case, in your question, it is hard because you have to go through that extra effort to prove something is not true of you, and that's unfortunate, but people are ready to grab onto these labels that we give. When George was asking before, why do we make judgments about people quickly? Well, if we hear something, the brain assumes it's fact unless there's reason to disbelieve it. And
well,
unfortunately,
I'll say something that I've learned from just watching these people in situations mm-hmm. is I've analyzed them, and I've just looked at them, and I was really fascinated by them. One of the things I noticed is the people that make really slanderous, outrageous lies against other people at work and other places, they usually come from a low socioeconomic group. They're usually not very well educated, and
really?
They're kind of poor. That's my impression. That's what I've kind of noticed.
I would think that the person who, was out to succeed could also be a culprit, don't you?
So I think that more important than SES would be the social status of the individual within the context of the slander. So if you're talking about the workplace, then is this person sort of at a junior level, or are they at a senior level? My guess is that most people who engage in this type of slander are those who are sort of at the lower rung of their company's hierarchy, because as Dave said, it seems to be about status acquisition. To the degree that you can push the guy who's on top of you down a couple rungs, that's going to bolster your status and ultimately lead to gains for you.
All right, let's go east of the Rockies. Nick is in San Antonio, Texas, one of our fine towns. Nick, go ahead. Welcome to the show.
Hi. My question is have the professors in their studies noticed about drug users and how
so? What do you mean, Nick?
They're good people for all intents and purposes, but they have to lie because their activities are illegal. And I'll take my response off air.
Yeah, well, one thing, okay. You know, because of ethical reasons, we don't ask people about issues about whether or not they use drugs or not, because we don't want to take that information from them. It's a good question, though. Just, you know, addiction in general, or using things that are illegal. I think to the extent that people engage in certain behaviors, you know, you can say is drug use morally wrong. In certain cultures, certain drug use is legal, so it's an open question. But whenever things you desire are forbidden morally, it sets up this trade-off that we're talking about between short and long-term. Yeah, I can use these things in the short term, but if I'm found out long-term, that probably spells really negative things for my reputation, my well-being. And the question is, what pushes people to make the decision that, well, you know what, I don't really care, I'm going to take this opportunity now? And as research has shown, lots of things going on in people's environment can make you more willing to do that at times.
Well, this is dramatic work. Now, what are the percents, if you can say that, what are the percents of a married guy, a married woman, cheating in their lifetime? Do we know? Or someone who's going to cheat or lie? What are the percents out there? Because clearly we can't accuse everybody, right?
Right. So I'm not familiar with the percentages. I know that there are some surveys that attempt to get comprehensive numbers, but obviously there are problems with that type of data collection. Right. On the one hand, you might not be getting representative samples. On the other hand, how many people are telling the truth? So I'm not sure what the percentages are, Dave. Maybe you have a better sense. But whatever they are, they're
I know they're not nil, but then they're not everybody. So, yeah. I think, you know, the question is, you know, most of us may not do this, but I think a lot of people will feel temptations at a time. And Carlo, and my main message is, what you have to understand is that character isn't all about self-control, because there are going to be times, things in the situation that are going to increase the odds that you're not going to be able to engage in self-control, whether you've engaged in drinking, which is going to lower your inhibitions, whether you have certain hormonal responses that are going to increase your odds of wanting to cheat with someone. And so it's really about realizing that if you want to guide your moral character the way you want it to go, then you have to pay attention to what situational influences will increase the odds that you're going to give in to that temptation. And by knowing that, you gain greater control.
And I think that's particularly true when it comes to matters of infidelity. So, you know, you look at high-profile examples of people who cheat, like Tiger Woods, and, you know, if you haven't cheated yourself, then you can point your finger and condemn him. But it's hard to imagine what you yourself would do if you were in this situation, if you had the opportunity to do these things. You know, I don't have women throwing themselves at me whenever I walk out the door. I don't know what I would do if I did. I would certainly be in a much different situation than I am right now.
All right, let's go to our wild card line. Dell is in Los Angeles. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi, Dell.
Hi, George. You know, I've got a question. I'm a hypnotherapist.
All right.
And I work with people that take an adjective and they turn it into an abstract noun. That adjective is a describer, and they make that describer a real thing, and it motivates them. It slows them down. It destroys their life sometimes. Did you ever study how the people, you know, can change their whole life around by going with an adjective and making a thing out of it?
I'm not exactly sure what you mean by going with an adjective.
Well, you know, an abstract noun. I took this NLP course, neuro-linguistic programming, and we got into abstract nouns of how the people can be totally turned around, by means of a or that they can turn themselves around by means of an adjective, that they can see the red color on the car, and the car it's not the car, you know, is the real thing to them. It's the red. You know, it's that thing, you know, where that they just get so hypnotized by an adjective rather than being real with the real thing.
Well, we haven't looked at language, but I think, you know, the analog is there in the sense that if you're able to change the way you're looking at a situation, if you're able to change the things that you think are important, that can definitely change your behavior. But as far as looking at actual grammatical usage, no, we haven't looked at that.
Yeah, because, you know, that, it is so interesting when you know, I watched, you know, TV, and after that course, I started watching TV and these infomercials, and these infomercials start advertising the product, but they wind up with, you know, with the description as being the noun, and it affects us so much. I mean, people are turned on by abstract nouns, and it's just fascinating to me how that they can do it. And after that, I started working with my clients and realize, wow, you know, this is a big thing with people.
Okay, good. Thanks for that call. Let's go to our next caller in Long Beach, California, on the wildcard line. Welcome to Coast, Sam. Go ahead.
Hi, guys. Good to talk to you again, George.
You too, Sam.
I don't know if they've done any kind of studies, but it's really, really odd. I mean, early on, I would be able to meet, different friends, clients, people that are about to get married and everything, and I would be coming back telling my wife, that guy's no good, it's not going to last, this and that. And she would say, you have no right to say that. You seem really nice. But then time and time and time again, I'm always proven right. And then now they'll actually ask me to go when they're doing this and that. And you know, it's a terrible position. You can't really tell them. You know, it's hard to when you see something, but are there certain people that seem to see through a lot just on their own? I mean, I come from a family. Well, just my aunt was just unbelievable at doing that kind of stuff. And nobody else in my family, nobody else around has. But it's just really, really, really odd where, you know, we'll come back from anything. And my wife will go, so what do you think of them? What do you think is going to,
all right,
know?
Let's get their answer. And we only have a minute before the break. Go ahead, David, you first.
Yeah, well,
Carlo.
You know, definitely some people are much more intuitive about these things. And what we've shown is that if you attend to actually subtle cues in people's behavior, especially their nonverbal cues, you often get a better sense of kind of what their motivations are than if you kind of rely on their character label or what people are thinking about them. And, you know, if we have time later, I'll tell you about that. We study this with actually humanoid robots, where we actually can actually have the robots engage in certain gestures, and we can make people trust the robots, believe the robots are going to cheat them in economic games, et cetera. And so I think you're hitting on an important point. Some of us are a lot more sensitive to these cues, and if we pay attention to those cues, even non-consciously, we're going to be much more accurate than if we try and rely on labels or what other people's reputations may be.
Well, no doubt about that. Where do you get your book, David, Out of Character?
You can get it at Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com or any of the major retailers like Barnes & Noble, Borders, etc.
All right. Well, stay with us. We're going to come back and take final phone calls with both of you as we talk about this incredible study, incredible work. It really is fascinating into the mindset of humans. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, Dr. Bruce Goldberg joins us as we talk about reincarnation and some of his work. When we come back, Out of Character, we'll continue to take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dave, is this the first time anybody's ever done a work like this or study?
You know, there have been a lot of books looking at decision-making in psychology, but most of them kind of focus on financial decision-making or decision-making having to do with things in business. I think this is really the first one that looks at decision-making in the moral domain and really how it plays out in people's real lives, looking at the vices and virtues taken together.
All right, great. And how about you, Carlo? When you did this study, did you expect these results?
As I said before, it's always a bit surprising to find these results. And this has to do with just how subtle the experimental manipulations that we use are. But you know, all our hypotheses are grounded in a literature that goes back to the roots of social psychology. I mean, people have been studying or asking questions about morality and aggression and altruism for the past century. So even though they're surprising results, they make sense given what we knew before about people's character.
But I think to most people, what is so surprising about it is it kind of turns the common sense notion of character on its head. And I think that's what we're arguing in this book is, you know, what we think about character as being this stable thing we learn early in life is pretty much an illusion. And we all have a lot more variability than we would like to think. And so accepting that is kind of the first part of being able to gain some control over it.
All right, let's go to our west of the Rockies. We've got you, Eli, in Oregon. Go ahead, Medford, Oregon. Go ahead, Eli.
Hi, George. I'd like to stay on long enough to respond to them on this. It seems to me that there's a couple of major flaws in your research. One is this idea that people only will act on whether it's going to be a short-term gain or a long-term gain. You're ignoring the fact that there are actually some people who make their decisions based on their moral values, regardless of perceived short-term or long-term goals. And if you aren't aware that there are such people, then, you know, you're not going to be able to understand the research by not seeing those people.
All right, what's a react to that? Go ahead.
So one thing is that we're not claiming that people need to be consciously aware that the reason why they're acting in a particular way is because they have a short-term or a long-term interest. So it's perfectly possible that people have a set of moral rules that they strive to adhere to. We would just argue that the importance of having those moral rules is to create stable social groups within which we can flourish. And in fact, doing so, adhering to these moral rules serves our long-term interest.
Yeah, and I mean, most people in our studies, I think, believe the same thing that you do. The question, of course, is then why do so many of them actually, when push comes to shove, do different things? And again, this is why we don't ask people, what do you think you would do? We actually put them in situations where, you know, admittedly, the majority of our subjects will actually tell us, you know, I never assumed I would do that, and that's an interesting thing. No, and so I think people believe they follow these clear moral principles, but lurking under the surface are these other pressures that are pushing you one way or the other.
Okay, Eli, any follow-up to that?
Yeah, are you saying that you have never found anybody who acted on their moral values despite your temptations?
No, and, you know, in fact, what we're talking about is the law of large numbers. So what we can show is by manipulating subtle factors in the environment, we'll increase the odds that percentages of people will behave one way or the other. What we are saying, though, is that for many, many people, some people may take a higher price or a higher payoff than others, but the temptations are always going to be there. I mean, even if you look back to Scripture, you know, St. Paul will always say, I try to do what is good, but I just can't. And why is that? And the reason is because there are these impulses, and they're not good and they're not evil. In the short term, you know, we want to do things that are good for us because not everybody makes it to the long term. And so there are these pressures that evolution has put into us that are lurking there. And when you're not paying attention or when you're tired or when you're making quick decisions, those things can alter your behavior and go against beliefs that you consciously hold.
What about the good liar, David, the person you meet and you go, what a nice person, what a good guy. But you know what? But behind the scenes, he'd steal from you. He'd do whatever he had to do. There's some experts like that.
Yeah, there are, you know, and again, that's the trade-off, right? You are trying to make people think that you are really good and really comfortable and that you like them. And what you're really doing is planning that you're going to cheat them. Now, that can work for you in the short term, right? And so if I can convince you that you can trust me and then I cheat you, well, I've gotten away with it. To the extent that you can get away with that over and over again, you build resources. And again, you know, Carlo and I aren't saying this is a good thing to do, but biologically, if you gain resources, there is some impulse to to do that. The problem is it's hard to do that continually without getting caught, unless you're continually on the move to different social groups that don't know you. And if you are, well, then maybe it's possible. But sure, I completely agree with you. There are people who kind of know those subtle cues, like your last caller was talking about, two callers ago, that can lead us to believe that they really care about us.
Let's go to Dana Point, California. First-time caller. Bill's with us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, George, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Yeah, hey, listen, you know, I've had some experience with these people at work who exaggerate, put other people down for their betterment. And, you know, I've been in business for a long time. And I've come to the conclusion that most of these people who do this are very insecure people. And they tend to put other people down to make themselves look better. Any comment on that?
Which one was it?
I think that that's certainly a part of it. So on the one hand, putting other people down makes us feel better about ourselves. On the other hand, putting other people down makes us look better to other people. There are advantages in both sides of that. And particularly in a situation like the workplace where there are limited resources, i.e. jobs and money, and people are competing for those limited resources, the desire to feel good about oneself as well as the desire to be seen as competent by others are magnified.
Yeah, and you know, we talk about this in the book as well. You know, pride, it's got a bad rap. You know, most of the synonyms for pride are negative in the dictionary, but actually what we found is that people who express pride, people really want to follow them. So just quickly, we would do studies where we would make one person feel proud by giving them some good feedback on a task. We then put them in a group, and what would happen is this person would just start to take over the group, and they would start to kind of act in a dominant way and try and guide what everybody else was doing. But the interesting thing was everybody else around them liked them for it. They didn't see them as being bossy. They actually liked it. It was a very attractive thing. They saw them as a leader. Now, of course, if these people then get unmasked, like you're saying, they really are insecure and they don't deserve this status, then they'll not like them. But in the short run, if you can fool people by putting down others or by puffing yourself up, those cues, those subtle cues, just make you more attractive and people are more likely to kind of follow you.
All right, let's go to Spokane, Washington. Jim's with us, west of the Rockies. Jim, you're up.
Yes.
Hey.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering what your guests' opinion were on the movie The Vanishing with Jeff Bridges and Kiefer Sutherland.
The classic, Drink the Coffee, Jeff. I remember that one. Remember that, you guys?
So I think I've seen the original version. Was it Swedish?
Hey, no, it was English. It was a great movie about a guy who wanted to kill someone, and he picked up a woman who left her husband's car.
Right.
And he got her, and Sandra Bullock played that part. And toward the end of the movie, the husband realized she had died, but wanted to know how she died. And so Jeff Bridges wanted him to experience exactly what she went through. And he drugged the coffee, and he did the whole thing. And the guy woke up in a coffin, and it was horrible, but he got out. You know, here's another guy who normally the community loved him. You could trust him. He had a family. You know, it's almost like that BKT killer, or BTK, the guy from Wichita, who you know, was in a clergy. And nobody knew that the guy was a serial killer. How do these people do this?
Well, I think when we're talking about that level, we are talking about minds that are rather deranged. And, you know, there, one thing we know about serial killers is that their normal emotional responses aren't there. And so many of us, right, you know, when there's this famous example where if you ask someone, you know, is it okay to basically, if a trolley's running down the tracks and you can flip a switch so that instead of running over five people, it runs over one, should you do that? Everybody says, yeah, you should save five lives instead of one. But if you ask people, well, this time there's a trolley running down the tracks and it's going to run over five people, but if you throw one big guy in front of it, it'll stop the trolley and he'll die. It's still five versus one, but everybody says, no, we can't do that. Now, logically, it's the same. But the reason we say we can't do that is because the idea of physically causing harm to this guy by pushing him, our kind of emotional response in our mind just says, no, you can't do that. With serial killers, the problem is that those emotional responses to directly causing harm to someone just aren't there. Whether it's biological or whether it's something that happened to them traumatic, we don't know. It could be either. But once you take out those kind of normal responses to causing pain to another, it allows these horrific acts to happen.
Let's go to Moore Park, California. It's John's turn on Coast to Coast. John, you're up with us. Go ahead.
Hi, George. I'm the guy that called back a few months ago. My friend and I met the serial killer down in L.A. I gave him $20.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That was a great call. Strange call, but a great call.
My question is, it was 10 years ago this July 4th that a friend of mine was kidnapped, raped, and murdered. And I was wondering if what your guests thought about the theory that some people are just born pure evil.
All right. That's a good one. David, are people born pure evil?
I would say, and again, you know, normal people, no. But just like there are all types of psychological impairments that one can have, whether it's involved in language or memory, individuals can surely have psychological impairments that blunt these normal pro-social emotional responses. You know, we talk about character as being a balance between what's good for me, what I enjoy, and then much more selfless acts, what's good for those around me. And we're always trying to balance those two in normal social life. But if you are born in such a way that those normal responses, these kind of moral sentiments that we have that make us feel compassion and gratitude aren't there, then that can lead a person, I would imagine, to be someone that we would call evil, because they lack those impulses that in some ways make us attuned to taking care of others around us. And in most of us, there's always this trade-off between what's good for me and what's good for others. But if you can short-circuit those, then yeah, I think individuals can be at least classified evil in that way.
What about the person who's not prone to lying, cheating, or doing many of the things that you write about in the book out of character, but they're manipulated by someone very easily, so they can be swayed to do things that they normally would not do? Are there a lot of people like that out there, David?
Well, you know, I mean, Carl, tell me what you think about it, but I think what the book shows is that a lot of us can be manipulated, and in fact, we often, you know, are. By, you know, what's the essence of a con man? The essence of a con man is someone who really knows some of these subtle signals. They know how to make you feel a certain way before they ask you a question, because they don't understand the science behind it, but they understand that manipulating these feelings will change your decision-making. And so I think a lot of us are a lot more manipulable. What do you think, Carlo?
Well, I think that being easily manipulated is not necessarily a horrible strategy. So obviously in the short term, it's going to get you into trouble when the cheater comes along and takes advantage of you. But to some degree, it's an honest signal to people in your environment that you're someone that can be trusted. And what we're arguing in the book is that being someone who's capable of being trusted is quite beneficial. You tag yourself as a safe interaction partner. So in that sense, trusting everyone around you can lead to some types of long-term benefits.
Okay, David's in Dallas, and he's on Coast to Coast. David, go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hi.
I have been in law enforcement, been around law enforcement my whole life, and I've been in the prison, working at the prison for almost 18 years now. I've been privy to all the crimes that were committed by the inmates in my care. I've seen some horrific things, and I've come to the conclusion that if anyone at all, humans, can do any of these crimes, these horrific things, I feel like everyone is capable of it, and I'd like to get your take on that.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, that's what we're arguing now. Now, you know, I think at a certain level of horrific action, you have to be missing a certain part of your mind that would prevent you from doing that, because it's always about finding the balance. And to go too far to the extreme to see and do the things that you've probably been privy to means that these individuals have kind of lost touch with certain parts of their mind. It's not like committing a crime of passion. That can happen if we're caught up in the moment. But the argument of the book is that the character is really a scale, and it's tipping back and forth between kind of these actions that are good for you and good for society. And individual elements in our environment can tip us one way or the other. So I think we would both agree with you that in essence, you're right. People's behavior is a lot more variable for good and for bad than any of us would like to admit.
Okay, we go now to David in Bristol, Tennessee. You're up, David.
Hey, how's it going?
Okay,
I'm just curious as to what age group these gentlemen tested.
Age group?
Undergraduate population, so tends to be 18 to 21-year-olds. But they're all undergraduates at various colleges and universities.
That's kind of what I figured. Young people. I believe if you tested an older group, you'd find that the results would be much, much different.
You think? In which way?
I just the morality standpoint of it. I'm 51 years old, and I don't lie. I try really hard to be honest and understanding of others. I think the age group would be a different result.
Okay, let's talk about that. And you, David, probably are in the minority in terms of that, but do you think it would skew differently, David and Carlo, if you had older folks in there?
Well, you know, I think certain things might, right? As one ages, a lot of the issues that we're talking about in terms of, you know, cheating on spouses and sex, et cetera, become less important biologically once you're older. But I would think the other things don't. I mean, what we know about as the mind ages is it tends to lose executive control. And what I mean by that is the ability to kind of really control these more subtle impulses that go on. I think later in life, your environment just tends to be a little more stable than it is when you're young. When you're in college, things are changing dramatically. I mean, if your life is stable, then your situation isn't changing as much moment to moment. But I think when the situations change, you know, older people are going to be subject to the same types of trade-offs and effects.
Well,
I think one look at the newspapers will show you that adults are capable of just as much lying, cheating, and stealing as young folks.
Sure. Look at Bernie Madoff. Look what he did.
Yeah, you have Bernie Madoff. You have DSK. You have lots of these individuals. Exactly.
Many, many, many. Okay, you two, thank you so much. The name of the book, Out of Character. Fascinating study and research project about surprising truths about the liar, cheat, sinner, and saint lurking in all of us. Maybe, though, all of us should do a little review, a little personal review. You never know. A little tune-up doesn't hurt. Up next, Dr. Bruce Goldberg, reincarnation. How many times have you been born? Let's find out.